Recording is now started. This is the White Taro webinar with Cortland Dahl and Antonia Simundo. Welcome, Cortland and Antonia.
Hey, everyone. Great to be on with you, Antonia. I'm going to kick us off here, and Antonia is going to wrap things up at the end. And in between, I think we'll both be hopefully having a nice discussion with you all. So I don't have too much to say here at the beginning. I thought I would maybe just mention a lot of what I imagine most of you already know or have heard at various points, which is just generally why we do these practices. And this is, of course, development stage, sadhana practice, DD yoga. These are all different ways of saying the same thing, where we're using the imagination essentially as a way, a skillful way to connect with our own Buddha nature. So in other words, connecting with the nature of our own minds. And part of this that I think is really amazing about the Vajrayana in general and these practices specifically is that there's a way of using these very natural energies of our experience, these natural rhythms of our experience, and just channeling that towards recognition. So most importantly with these practices, it's really about the imagination and not just kind of imagination in the sense of making things up that aren't actually the case, but just this very basic capacity of the mind to be projecting into the future, remembering things that have happened, to be kind of creatively envisioning what might be or connecting with what actually is. So the idea with these practices is not that we're kind of creating some made up version of reality that isn't in line with how things actually are. The idea is actually rather that we normally in our typical day-to-day lives get stuck in ways of thinking where we're viewing all that's going on in our experience as fundamentally flawed or problematic. In other words, what we in the tradition we would call impure perception. And the insight here is that it is actually this impure perception that is not seeing things clearly. Not that when we envision ourselves to be a Buddha, when we imagine everything around us and the people around us to be Buddhas, that is made up. It's actually that is closer to how things actually are than our normal way of viewing things, which again is filtered through this idea that that we're incomplete or that there are these flaws that pervade our experience. So part of what's going on in these practices is that we're learning to use the imagination in such a way, these things that are already happening in the mind, but we're imagining a world and ourselves and our experience. We're using this capacity that the mind has in such a way that it helps to loosen up the old habits of impure perception. And begins to help us gain confidence in this idea that hopefully the experience, not just the idea, the experience, the felt experience, that there is something inherently pure and whole about ourselves and about the world. And the forms that we use, visualizing ourselves as Waitara, for example, imagining all these Buddhas, imagining the palace, all these different things, it helps to undo all these old habits. And then at the end, when we dissolve all of that, we are letting go of the attachment we can get or we can develop towards the new version of reality. So when we take it together with the completion stage, and one part of that being when we dissolve and then we just rest at the end in a kind of a natural state where we're no longer imagining all these things. When you put that together, we are both loosening up all these old habits and opening up to the possibility of pure perception, and then simultaneously, from time to time, dropping into this more open, receptive state so we don't get too caught up and attached in this new version of reality that we have, in some sense, created. But at its core, this is in many ways no different than pointing out instructions, in that all of this is guiding us back to our own inherently pure nature. Everything is just a skillful means to help us get a taste of that and then to integrate that with the body, with the mind, with relationship, with the world around us, with all of these different things. So we can, it's easy to get lost in all the complexity of these practices, but yet it's very important to always come back to this key point of just simply connecting with our own awakened nature and viewing everything as an opportunity to come back to that and to hopefully access and stabilize that simple recognition. So there's a lot of moving parts here. I imagine that there's questions on specifics with these practices, and this is a new practice for us as a community. So both individually and as a community, we're still kind of working out the kinks here. But maybe we could just pause there and open it up and see what comes up in the discussion.
So, yes, Scott, I don't really know what to add, but there was one thing you said, and that was about the natural rhythm of experience. And as I was looking forward to this webinar, then one of the things that I really looked forward to is to hear from people, you know, about how your experience is with this practice. Now we've been engaged in it for some time. And just this, the unfolding of the familiarity with the practice, the sense of the practice opening up, and that connection between starting with the nature of mind or starting with emptiness, and also that's where we are ending, that these are never separate. Appearance and emptiness is never separate in this practice. And just in my own experience working with it, just seeing how that always go together and just finding it extremely fascinating.
Okay, thank you, Antonia, and thank you, Cortland. And as I said at the beginning, we have a few questions written in already. And there is one hand raised. I want to encourage people, if you do have live questions you'd like to ask, go ahead and raise your hands. And there was one, I hope, Leyland, this wasn't from our test, but you have your hand raised, so I'm going to unmute. Oh, actually, nope, the hand went down. So our first question comes from Marianne. And Marianne, you are muted on your end, so if you just unmute yourself. I can hear you. There you go.
Hi. Okay, great. Hi, Cort. Hi, Antonia. And also, Max. Great to see you guys. Antonia had asked about the practice, and I have to say that I really love this practice. It's just so beautiful, so I'm just enjoying it very much. And right now I'm doing the speech part of it. And my question concerns the emanation part, where there's four different types of emanations that you're going to do while you're visualizing the tom syllable. And it concerns the second and fourth emanation. The second emanation says we emanate out light from the tom syllable, helping all beings in a myriad of ways. And then the fourth emanation says that we emanate the light out and it reaches living beings in all directions and enhances their vitality and longevity. I'm wondering if you can tell us the difference between those two emanations, and also if any of them are meant to embrace all of the different realms, including the hell realm and the hungry ghost and all the lower realms. If we're sending light to those places in one specific of these emanations, or is it the same, or I'm not quite sure what the difference is.
What?
So I think there's, in some respects, the movement is quite similar. I mean, there's maybe more of a difference in terms of the kind of a specific flavor, in particular of the second one, or I guess we're talking about the fourth of the four. So the first one, the first two, where you're kind of emanating out all the offerings to all the Buddhas, you're gathering them back in, and then you're emanating out again to all sentient beings. That's kind of the general development stage practice where you would do in any development stage the emanation and absorption. And so you can imagine in the second, pardon my voice, you can imagine in the second part of that, pardon me just a minute, I'm just going to take a drink. In the second part of that, when it's meant to go out and be benefiting all sentient beings, that's kind of an open-ended movement where you can imagine, going out to all the different realms, helping all beings, both in a kind of a temporary sense, alleviating suffering, helping bring about their well-being, and of course, more in an ultimate sense, dissolving the obscurations, helping them recognize their true nature, all of these things. So in that kind of more general way of emanating light to all sentient beings and all the realms, it really can be anything. It can be, again, using the imagination, it's really quite beautiful, but just using the imagination and whatever calls connects with your inspiration to imagine just helping beings in whatever way, whatever ways we can help them. And again, here using the imagination, so that can be as vast and as grand an aspiration as possible. But the second one that you mentioned, so I guess it would be the fourth of these four, it's the one that's more specifically linked to Waitara practice. So it has specifically using the same basic notion, but it's connecting up with longevity on a more relative sense. And then you could say kind of the deathless state, the state beyond birth and death, you could say, at a more ultimate level. So it's again using that same basic idea that we're just using the imagination as though we're going out and helping beings however we can. But in this case, we're imagining that we're specifically, as it connects with them, it's helping remove all of the obstacles to their life, to their longevity. And then, as I mentioned, on an ultimate level, helping them realize that part of themselves that is beyond birth and death, that's beyond the body, beyond the relative mind, that's really more about their Buddha nature and pure awareness, etc. So on that level, it's connecting more specifically, because you could almost think of it almost like a subset of that first one. And then when you're drawing that kind of back in, then it's again, it's almost like drawing this pure essence that contributes to our life force. So in a way that's not depleting, or taking it away from the world or away from other beings, but leaving both ourselves and others enriched. But again, specifically with this tie into our life force and longevity. So they're related, but it's the second movement is kind of a more specific one that's related to the aims of this practice in particular. So is that making sense at all? I don't think it needs to be quite this scripted, but I think there's an important difference between the two.
So is what you're saying the first one is more on a relative level and the second one is more on the ultimate level where you're really trying to get beings enlightened or having the causes of enlightenment?
So I wouldn't say it's ultimate relative because I think both have an ultimate and relative component. So even with just that very general movement of emanating light, out to all sentient beings that we do, you do it at the beginning of this practice as well. And again, here with the mantra, that has, you could say, I think has an ultimate and relative. And then the one that's more specific to longevity, that also has an ultimate and relative. I think the difference is that the first one is more general. It's just helping beings in whatever ways they can be benefited, both ultimate and relative. And then the when we emanate again to all sentient beings, it's then more specifically about Waitara practice in particular and the connection to longevity. And you could say there too, there's sort of an ultimate and a relative. So the ultimate, I'm kind of just looking at the guide here where it says, it reaches living beings and enhances their vitality and longevity. So that's kind of the relative side of that. And then on the ultimate level, you might remember there's a line from earlier in the sadhana when you're right before you start chanting the mantra where it talks about the deathless state. So that's the more ultimate side of that as well. So it's just more specific, I would say, is the main one, not necessarily ultimate relative.
Right. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. And we have another hand raised. It's actually from Patricia, who also wrote in a question. So I'm just going to, Patricia, maybe you have your ask your question live. Hi, Patricia.
Oh. Hello. Yes, good to see you all. My question was about the hand mudras. And when we were in Minnesota, we did see a video, and I was wondering if there's any access to that. And I don't see a lot of reference to the mudras in the practice. I've been trying to do them, but I get a little confused.
Okay. So have you been to the White Tara page at the Vajrayana online?
Yes.
Yes.
So, is it there?
Yes. Yes. Oh, so there's the video with Rinpoche chanting the practice and Rinpoche also doing the mudras.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I hadn't. Okay, I didn't realize it was right there. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Antonia, do you want to take a quick look? I'll show people. I'll share the screen and show that page.
Yeah, it's a good idea, so everybody has seen.
Yeah, so this has been up for a while, and everybody who's on this call has been invited to view in Vajrayana Online the White Tara page. So you should have a code that allows you access. If you don't. You don't need to contact Antonio or Court. Just send it to me at tlcsupport@turgot.org, and we'll get you set up. So I'm going to share my. Let's see. Are you seeing it now?
Yes.
Yeah. I got to get some of this other stuff out of the way. So on this page, you access it by going over to the Practicing White Tara. I think most of you have been there, but if you're kind of new to it, you haven't looked, you go to log into Vajrayana Online, go to the Practicing White Tara from the blue bar, and then you have to go into the second page, which has the actual content. And this contains the liturgy, the daily chants, White Tara guide for practice, and some suggested readings, and the video, and somewhere in the video along the way here, Rinpoche does the mudras. And the previous White Tara webinar with Myoshin and Tim is also, actually it was just with Tim, is on here. And this webinar will be posted on here after today, so you'll be able to listen back. Okay, I think that's all I have on that.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Patricia. And if you have any questions, let us know. So let's stick with the live. We want to make sure we get people in live here because we don't do these webinars very often. So Jane Tara has her hand raised.
I'm muted. Can you hear me?
You're unmuted now.
Okay. Hi. Hi, Court. Hi, Antonio. Matt.
Hi.
First, in terms of Antonio saying about the practice, just I've been practicing White Tara for several years now. I started with the original Turgot White Tara. And have been in a couple of months of retreat with White Tara. And in terms of my practice, I started out with Kempo Karta's book, which I highly recommend. I just think that is a fabulous book in terms of getting down sort of the nuts and bolts of what you do and even the mudras and everything. You have it there, and it's a great adjunct to the video. But what has happened is over the time of practicing, of course, there's this learning curve where you learn all of the details and do it very, very specifically. And then once I got Minger's instructions doing the four different ways, but as I've been practicing, all of that has seemed to sort of, it's there, I know it, but it's sort of melted away. And it only with great force can I bring it back. So it seems like the mind wants to settle into this, okay, I'm Tara and let's just be there and do the practice. So anyway, that's just That's just my experience. So, but I do have a couple of very technical questions. And one is mainly about the accumulation of the mantras. Because I started with the original Teragar White Tara, do my mantras from then count as the accumulation or not? And also, are we doing a million or are we doing 1,100,000, blah, blah, you know, that kind of thing like we do with the Nundro? So those are my questions.
Colin, do you want to?
What?
Yeah, so on the first part of that, I can't say that we've talked to Rinpoche about it, or at least Antonio, let me know if you've heard anything. But I would assume that it counts, you know, that the mantras that you've accumulated using either Kangtul Rinpoche's or the previous Situ Rinpoche's sadhana, that those same mantras you can count towards the accumulations here. But it's a good question for Rinpoche.
Yeah.
And we can check on that. Antonia, have you heard anything different about that?
No, I haven't heard.
Yeah, and it's a really good question about the accumulations as well. I mean, I think pretty much any sadhana you do, you always add in there's like a term for it where you add in basically like the 10% that you probably screwed up, which at least if I'm in any example of that, that's a very generous generous assumption about how much we screw up. But anyways, you typically always add that in. And so again, I think we can check with Rinpoche on that. But that's just sort of a kind of a baseline with sadhana practices. But again, Antonia, have you heard anything to indicate otherwise with that?
No.
Yeah. So, but that, you know, why don't we assume that that's the case? And it's good to hear these questions because it's just things we can check with Rinpoche and make sure that we're putting out the what he has in mind. So we can check on that. And if there's anything other than that, we'll certainly let all of you know.
And then about the way the practice is evolving, I assume that's natural, but sometimes I wonder, should I really force myself to do the visualizations in a clear way, the way they were in the beginning?
You want to speak to that, Antonia?
I think it's, I think one of the things that Rinpoche is saying is that the most important is actually that we trust it and that we experience it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that I would look for, and to see if there really is that conviction that I'm Tara and this is the world that I'm in and that everything is happening. So I think that's what I would say. And I think this is what Kempo Kunga very much mentioned also when we were receiving it, that these instructions and the language, everything has such a weight on nature of mind. So I think once we have the pointing out instructions and have been practicing that, I think that's probably where we're going to lean very, very soon to go in that direction.
I see. That makes sense, Antonia, and trusting is a big part of it, because I think it's all there. Once you learn it, it's all there. It's like you don't have to keep repeating your name to remember it, that kind of thing. But it does, I mean, for me anyway, it changed radically. Thank you.
Jane?
Thanks,
Jen. And we'll go to, actually, Maura had written a question, also has her hand raised, so let's go to Maura. Welcome to the webinar. Maura, you are muted on your end. There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes. Great. It's wonderful to see you all. Thank you very much. And hello to all the fellow practitioners out there. I like thinking about all of you when I'm practicing, thinking about everybody doing it together. I have a question about working with the three samadhis in this practice. I know that Mingyur Rinpoche, in his introduction to the development stage in Vajrayana Online, he talked about these three samadhis, the emptiness, and then the all-illuminating compassion, and then the combination of those two, the seed syllable. And I've read that they serve to kind of purify the illusions of death, the bardo and rebirth, and also that they're connected to the three kayas. So I guess my questions are maybe a little like what Jane Tara was talking about, in the sense of how specifically should they be applied at certain places in the sadhana? Because it seems like there maybe are some particular places where you could pause and maybe rest in those samadhis. Or is it more just kind of how it all unfolds naturally? And I guess the other thing that occurs to me is that seems like those three samadhis are really the, you know, if they're the three kayas, they're kind of what everything is, what all our experiences are. Mm-hmm. So I just, not quite sure. I've never done a deity practice before, so I'm just curious how to work with that. Thank you.
Okay. Should I say something first, Kurt, and then you can say something? Yeah.
So
first of all, as I understand it, I mean, the three samadhis are there, even though we don't explicitly use those terms in this practice. But the first samadhi, the samadhi of suchness, that's emptiness. And we begin the sadhana practice with the emptiness mantra and experiencing everything as emptiness. So that is the experience of the samadhi of suchness.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of emptiness arises, emptiness is not nothing. So emptiness has qualities, emptiness has compassion, and out of emptiness arises the Hong, and that's the, so we have the samadhi of illumination. And then with the seed syllable, we have the samadhi of the syllable. So they're actually there, and we are experiencing them, and we are experiencing how it's never separate. Like we talked about before, that emptiness and appearance is never separate. Emptiness and compassion is never separate.
Mm-hmm. It seems as though in the practice, you're kind of trying to kind of experience the evolution of coming out of emptiness with compassion, and then sort of emerging as a seed syllable for the benefit of all beings. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, though, how if that's something that should be, you know, consciously directed, or as you're saying, it kind of flows.
Yeah, I think this is part of our experience, isn't it? And it goes very well with our experience also, that emptiness is not nothing, that it has a flavor, and so it does unfold in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that it's probably one of the things as we are practicing, that we will deepen our experience of the three samadhis. This is what we are practicing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And Court, did you have anything to add?
No, that was really beautiful. I mean, just one very technical thing, which is that the three samadhis are something that you hear a lot about, especially in the Nyingma tradition. And in the sadhanas you do in the Nyingma tradition, oftentimes they might not mention the words of the three samadhis, but there's usually lines in the sadhana that will very, very explicitly be relating to them. But as Antonia mentioned, in this sadhana, you know, it's they're kind of the, as an experience that you could be bringing in throughout the sadhana, but most explicitly it's these, it's when you do the Om Svabhava at the beginning, is where you kind of drop into the samadhi of suchness. And it's one way to look at it is, rather than kind of moving through different things, it's almost like you're building upon experiences. So you connect deeply with the emptiness aspect, then seeing that compassion is there naturally within that, and then seeing that that naturally then expresses itself, you know, both in our life, but here in the sadhana as the form that the sadhana eventually takes shape. So it's seeing that awareness and compassion is naturally there within that. And then out of that, the movement of that compassion then takes the form of the seed syllable, and everything kind of springs from there. So in a Nyingma sadhana, you would start with that seed syllable, and then kind of everything kind of moves from that. So the structure of it on the surface is a little bit different. But in terms of the kind of at an experiential level, these are kind of the strands of the sadhana that are all woven together as kind of one thing. So you're seeing the emptiness within the form, you're seeing the compassion is infusing all of that. And it just reminded me of Rinpoche's story from when he was on retreat, when he had this near-death experience, which was very much a description almost of like the three samadhis, where he obviously wasn't doing it in this kind of structured sadhana way, but he had that moment where he almost passed away, and it was just this open space. And then there was this movement of compassion within that. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of led, you know, back to where he was back in his body and his life, but not leaving behind the emptiness and the compassion, but that re-engagement is kind of within that inner space of awareness infused with compassion and open space, emptiness, you know, suffused with compassion. So kind of we're almost training ourselves to just live in this space where all of this is kind of mixed in together, and we're just getting familiar with each of the pieces and then slowly bringing that all together. And sadhana is kind of like the container or the way that helps us to do that in a sense.
Oh, thank you so much. It's very helpful and very inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you, Maura. I want to go to some of the written questions. Amy had a couple from that she wrote at the beginning. And the first one is, the first line of dissolution says, everything that appears as the form of Tara, ... But in Rinpoche's instruction on mantra recitation, there is nothing about this. How literal is this, and should we visualize the whole universe as Tara, or just as it is, but think that it is Tara? Any help with this would be great.
This is a good question, and I can't say I've heard Rinpoche say in much detail about this, so I can maybe just say what I would assume that it means, well, just with the important footnote that this is my assumption. And I don't know, Antonia, maybe you've heard something more specific, but I assume that what we're just talking about here is that the mandala of Tara, that you're basically visualizing the entirety of existence as being the mandala of Tara. So that more kind of expansive view of what Tara is, an expression of that enlightened nature, and you're viewing all of these forms as kind of participating in that. And now all of those kind of more relative manifestations are then dissolving back into that. So not literally that every single thing is like a white Tara floating out there, but everything is kind of the embodiment of that awakened nature, and we're viewing it and imagining it as the mandala, and then we're dissolving that. I don't know, Antonia, I'm curious to hear if you heard anything or if that was what you would take it to mean as well.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard anything, but that would what I would take it to mean also. And it just reminds me of the sort of importance of remembering what Tara is, and not confuse it with the form, but really always remember what is it it's pointing to, and seeing that in everything, recognizing that in everything. Yeah.
Thank you. And Amy had she put a number as an extra question. So number two is, did Rinpoche suggest any way we can use the practice for a long life for others? For example, for our teachers, are there any specific visualization during the mantra recitation for a long life for others?
You have anything to say on that, Antonia?
No, I think there was a question during the one of the sessions with Rinpoche, but I cannot repeat what he said. But I think there was one who asked specifically about this, isn't it? Do you remember, Claude?
Frankly, I don't remember what Rinpoche himself said about this. It'd be a great question to ask, you know, for those of you who are at the retreat this summer. This would be a good one to bring up. I think what we can say is that it's very much a traditional practice to use White Tara as a way to, for specifically for others. And I think there's instructions in Kenpo Kartar's commentary. So this is when you do specifically do the longevity mantra, not the root mantra, but the longevity mantra. And then there's specific visualizations where you kind of visualize somebody within the sphere and you're doing a quite elaborate visualization. But Rinpoche, I don't remember Rinpoche teaching. Well, of course he didn't teach because he left. I just realized he wasn't there. Maybe Kenpo Kunga. I don't remember any in-depth instruction about it, but I think it would be great to ask him, you know, if this is something that we can or should do. But it's definitely part kind of there in the practice itself, as if you read the more elaborate sadhanas and you read the more elaborate instructions. There's a way to kind of do this both for either one's teacher or for somebody else who might, you know, there might be an obstacle to their life and so forth. But this would be a great one to explore further with, you know, with Rinpoche and Kenpo when we're all together.
Okay, thank you both. There is a comment written in from Jane Tara saying that, yes, in fact, that is described in detail in Kenpo Kartar's book. And just, I think most people probably, maybe they had it last year, I'm going to just drop it, a link to that book, The Wish Fulfilling Wheel, in the chat box here. For anybody who doesn't have it, you can order a copy. Okay, we have a couple
of... It's good to mention, you know, in relation to Kenpo Kartar's book, which is incredibly helpful. I mean, a really, really wonderful resource and very much based on a classical commentary by the first Jamgon Kongtrul. It's good. It's probably also helpful for us all to know that what you'll find in that commentary, much more detailed presentation of the stages of visualization. And Rinpoche, I think, has been quite intentionally simplified his version of the sadhana, and it doesn't incorporate a lot of that. So I don't know if he would, or I haven't heard him go so far as to say, like, you shouldn't do all of that. But I think, Antonia, as you mentioned earlier, this kind of the emphasis on nature of mind and the more, and I think, Jane Tara, also what you said about connecting with, I don't know if you use this word, but really kind of the felt Vajra pride of just I am Tara and not getting so hung up on all the specifics. I think there's something quite beautiful in Rinpoche's always going back to the essence and simplifying, is it just keeps the focus on these core elements. So that's all to say that if you read that book, and I would definitely recommend that you do, just keep in mind you'll find a lot of details which you don't necessarily need to incorporate in. You can stay with a simpler approach that Rinpoche has laid out, and bring in other things if you find them helpful, but not feel like you need to get every tiny detail right, because there's a lot of it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Amy, for those questions. Oh boy, there's been some comments on this topic, and Amy has her hand raised. And also, let's first go to Catherine, who said she wrote and she's got asked this question of Rinpoche last year.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Great. Hi. And by the way, I wanted to just say, Antonia, I love the statue behind you. It's beautiful.
I thought I would put out a White Tara statue.
So I don't know if this is the question that was being referred to, but I suspect it was at least one of them. I asked Rinpoche a question when he was on the screen in front of us in the room about using it for my sister, who I had learned had just gotten a very severe form of leukemia, just like during the retreat we learned it. And I wish I could remember all the details. So one question that I have now is whether we have access to the recording of that talk, because I don't think it's on the page, and it would be lovely to have that. But what I can say about my, what really went into my heart from what he said was that the connection of the person as they're practicing with the person whose life they're trying to contribute to is really important. And so I just took that to heart, and I think it relates to the sense of being Tara and deity pride or courage, that the importance of that situation somehow wiped away my tendency to doubt myself. And so I just completely went for it. And the whole, I immediately started practicing and was always practicing really almost up until today when I shifted a little bit for her. And felt like that was the best thing that I could give her. And who knows what has worked, because she's had wonderful medical care. But all we know is she seems to be well at this point, and she needs more care. She's on tons of medications. But, you know, I'm just not going to question what caused what. There's no question that the medical care is an important part of it. But I really feel that the White Tara has been an important part of my relationship with her and connecting. It's hard to put this in words, connecting the realms in which I do experience myself to be White Tara with the realms in which I don't act at all like any deity whatsoever. When triggered by things that are family or irritating or whatever, somehow this has been like a bridge, a connector that links these worlds that otherwise drift apart. So anyway, I really feel that it was not only being given the empowerment at that time, but what Rinpoche said in that conversation that mm-hmm. gave me that strength to do that. So I felt like it really was part of the blessings from Rinpoche. Thank you. So it's not really a question, it's more a comment, but I'm certainly interested in anyone else's related experiences.
So I just want to thank you so much, Catherine, for sharing that. I think this is really, really, really helpful to hear and very beautiful to hear. And I think this is, you know, this is an everyday example. So we can read about this, and we can, of course, have our own experience about the power of this practice. And I think every time that we just understand, like through your story, through our own experience, that we really start to more and more understand the power of the practice, and that it is not just imagining something, but that it is actually something that's closer to the way things are than the way that we usually live. And so that we feel inspired, we feel enthusiastic of, you know, spending more and more time in a way, in a state, in a mind state that's closer to the way things are, in a world that's closer to the way things are.
So also, by the way, the one concrete thing, there is a place in the Kenpo Kartar book where he talks personally about his experience with it and how he felt that it extended his life and how that works. And it was very encouraging to read that last spring. I think that contributed too. And I think people, if they haven't noticed that particular passage, might want to look at that. Mm.
Thank you for those comments, Catherine. You know, this topic on, Amy has her hand raised, and we have a few other hands raising questions, but Amy started this question, and I know this topic, you know, people are interested in dedicating their practice to the benefit of others. So it's great to hear your comments. So let's go back to Amy. And Amy, do you have something else to say about it, or a different question entirely?
Yeah, no, it's on this. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you so much, both of you. It's wonderful to see you and hear you, Max. I am a Kempo Karta Rinpoche student. I don't do the White Tara practice for my main practice, but it's been a great blessing to do it. And one thing, Antonia, you asked about personal experience. My personal daily practice is a wrathful deity, and this practice has helped me a great deal because somehow it's so much more natural and organic for me to connect with Tara, and then I can kind of transfer some of that devotion and feeling into my practice, which is in some ways more challenging for me. So I'm super grateful for it. I'm not going to qualify for the White Tara level yet this year, but I'm definitely interested if anyone wants to follow up and ask Rinpoche more about this question. I'd love to know what he says. But I guess my question in a nutshell, since, you know, Kempo Karta Rinpoche, it's very elaborate and detailed, as many people have noted, that, you know, the question in a nutshell is how, Court, you alluded to this, should we assume that we can transfer that practice into this one? Or is there a simpler, you know, Rinpoche has such a masterful way of simplifying for us. If he would like us to keep it simple and more experiential, I'm just interested to know. Thank you.
Yeah, I would say that I'm just trying to imagine if Rinpoche were here and we were talking to him about this. My guess is that you know, if there was something that you read in Kempo Karta Rinpoche's book and were thinking, oh, this really resonated with me, I didn't see it in the instructions, but I'd like to try it. My guess is he would say that by all means, if you want to explore some of these details that are not there, that you can certainly do that. But more importantly, that you don't have to, that if you want to kind of really keep it simple and stay focused on these elements, that that you can do that. And then he always, of course, goes back, now, as we've said a few times here, he always goes back to the essence. And one thing that I've seen over the years that you can kind of see in his general, Rinpoche's general approach, is how making sure that we view all these other details, all these different elements of the practice, as ways that can support and enrich and deepen our experience of nature of mind, rather than as things that we kind of can get hung up on, and as it almost like a distraction from that. So I think the key thing is not how much or how little of that we include, of these things that can be supporters, but just that we do view them as supports, that these are the things that can be helpful in loosening up the mind, that could be helpful in maybe integrating with some aspect of our experience, like our imagination, etc. But that we're viewing all of that in service of really exploring our own nature and seeing that in others, seeing that in the world around us, and then letting everything be kind of part of that movement and kind of go moving from within that space. And I know that from my own experience, in particular with these practices, because this whole realm is just not easy for me, and it never has been. There's certain elements that I connect with easier, but as you've heard me say many times, probably the visualization one has always been challenging. But I found that because it's been more challenging, there's like a natural phase that I go through, probably with any practice, but especially with these ones that are more challenging, where it feels somewhat artificial, where it feels kind of mechanical and like I don't quite get it yet. It feels like my practice might have felt really, you know, the things that I have worked with more and are easier for me feels like I can drop into the experience more easily. And then I'm doing this other stuff where it's like, forget about imagining a whole mandala, like a little sphere of white light would be an improvement, you know. So it's easy to get, you know, go through that phase where it's more challenging. But What I've heard Rinpoche say is that it's as a general guideline to spend time on these things that may be pushing up against our edge a little bit or a lot in some cases, to get a familiarity to the point where we do hopefully, even if it's never the easiest thing for us, at least we have a basis and experience and can see the value of it in our own experience. And then we make it our own. And then we can say, all right, still for me, you know, Vajra Pride is the thing that I really connect with, and I can focus on that and use these other elements as a support when it's helpful, but that we don't too easily dispense with the things that are a little more challenging for us. So I know for me, it's been hard because some elements have been really challenging and it's taken a while to fully appreciate them. But I think this all kind of just goes back to the general framework of practice and how we work with all of the richness that's there. So the simplicity, I think, helps us stay focused on what's the one thing we don't want to lose sight of, which is just the simplicity of our own true nature, not as, you know, some kind of complex thing, but just dropping into the direct experience of that.
Thank you. Well, Antonia and Cord at the beginning was saying, why don't we go over a little bit? And I think we have a little chance to go over. We're coming close to an hour, but if people want to stick with us, there's a couple more questions and comments. And one of them, I want to make sure I get to this. Someone just wrote an email in. Sorry, there was somebody, Chris, who was not able to be on the webinar, had some trouble connecting, wrote, my White Tara question is this. I've been practicing White Tara as my main practice since 1996 and have accumulated 1 million of the root mantra in retreat. At that point, I'd continued to do the practice but stopped further accumulation of the mantra. Should I still be counting? And part two, should I now begin accumulating the long life mantra rather than the root mantra as the central focus of my practice? Thank you, Chris. And if you're not on, I hope that you have listen to some recording. I'll reply to you in the email. Okay.
I just wanted to share one thing that I heard. One of my teachers was Tengu Rinpoche. And Tengu Rinpoche was practicing White Tara. Tengu Rinpoche, I think everybody considered that he was a person who really had realized White Tara. He was White Tara. He was known to, if he had, you know, to be in direct communication with White Tara. And I just know that he continued to count. He continued to count the mantras, and it was many, many, many millions that he had said. So I just thought that was very inspiring. That, you know, he did this practice his whole life. He did other things, of course, also, and. But he really accumulated a lot of the mantras. I don't know, Cord, about shifting to the long life mantra.
Yeah, for somebody who's done White Tara for 20 years as their main practice, I feel like I'd be a little. I don't know that I have anything, any pearls of wisdom I can or should impart. But it's certainly a part of the practice that I think is quite powerful about, or that's unique to White Tara, which is the longevity part of the practice. Again, just to go back to Rinpoche's way of holding this, is I think probably obvious to everybody. He's just very flexible, and I think something Antonia, you said at the beginning, kind of typifies that, which is really trust. You know, kind of really trusting our own wisdom and voice about what we want to explore and go deeper with in practice, and what's helpful and what's not always helpful. So certainly if you wanted to explore that, then for sure that would be, as part of the practice, certainly could do that. My guess is that, you know, as a sort of a general rule of thumb, if at that point you've done the practice, it's more what you find helpful and what brings your practice to life, you know, after many years of doing it, that I would focus on. But I always tend to the not being so good at following rules and traditions. So that's my maybe my personal bias with that. But again, this is the importance of having opportunities to practice and retreat with each other and with Kempo and Rinpoche, where we can talk about things like this. So hopefully we'll, if not this year, we'll all have this opportunity, you know, over the coming years. And hopefully we can have a webinar like this with Rinpoche as well. I imagine that we've already had a few general webinars with him. So as there's more and more people doing this as a main practice, I imagine we'll have webinars with Rinpoche so we can have these same questions with him. But that's, I just want to say, it's amazing and wonderful that you've practiced, practiced this as a main practice for so long. It's really beautiful.
Thank you both. And thank you, Chris, for that question. I hope we get a chance to see you on the retreat again this year. I want to go back, while we have a little time, to a question that's been waiting. Etienne has been waiting, I hope patiently. So I'll read the question. I am at the mind personality section focusing on Vajra pride. Do you visualize the emanations / absorptions during the stage or just the form of white Tara?
Oh, that's your... this is your favorite.
Yeah. So the focus on this is very much on Vajra pride, of just feeling, not getting too hung up on all the details of the practice, but just very much focusing on the sense of being white Tara. So that's for sure the emphasis. And I would say that, you know, within that space, that there's room, you know, to move with that. And if that doing the emanations is helpful, then doing that. I think it's, again, going back to this theme of trust and being more intuitive with it, that you can certainly be doing that within that space. It's just not the focus in the way it is with the speech section. So there's a beautiful thing, you know, in the classical instructions on the visualization of this kind of like instantaneous kind of visualization, where you're not kind of going through the script in your mind to doing everything at the right point, but it's just sort of like, it's just there. And it's like, you are white Tara. And if like you are in being in that space of being white Tara, if it's just that natural sense of devotion and offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, letting that come out. If it's a natural sense of compassion and connecting with others, just letting that kind of come out. But the focus is really on the Vajra pride aspect. So it's more a matter of emphasis than like you can no longer, I mean, that's still part of it. It's just more the emphasis is on that element. I don't know, Antonia, any thoughts on that?
No, this is fine. Thank you.
Thank you. And Etienne says many thanks. Just want to go back to a couple more questions. There's a comment here from Marianne. Says, in Kempo's book, the lady who helped fund the book had stage 4 cancer and thought she was going to die. Kempo Kartho Rinpoche gave her the white tar empowerment, and within a month, she was led to a doctor who was able to heal her. She said that the cancer is still in remission 15 years later. Yeah. Oh, if anyone, I was going to say, if you have doubt the practice, maybe go see Kempo Kartho if you have an opportunity. He's in his 90s now, and it's sort of interesting. He seems to get a little younger every year, and he has this very youthful, boyish glow, you know, about him. It's really wonderful. Corp, you were going to say?
I was just going to say the lesson to me of that is, if at all possible, sponsor a book on the practice of white Tara.
There might be an opportunity coming up for that, we hope. Thank you, Marianne, for that comment. Let's see if we maybe have a couple of minutes. There's a couple of people want to make sure we get, there was a question written in from Renee, and she has her hand raised. So I want to unmute Renee and welcome you to the webinar. Renee, you're muted on your end, so you'll have to unmute yourself. You're on, well, all right, let's see if she could unmute it up in the meantime, or maybe the hand went down now. I will read the question that came in, because this is a kind of a more pragmatic question that came in about practicing. Renee wrote, will we have opportunities to practice white Tara together at St. Thomas?
It's a very positive answer. Yes, we will.
Okay. Maybe that was the simplest question of the day.
That's my only hope for a sadhana practice, is that at least I can be in the room with other people who appear to be visualizing. I'll be happy at this point, even just to know somebody who can visualize well.
Just being in the room, yeah. Oh, wait, actually, Renee, it looks like your microphone's on. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for answering the question. I look forward to practicing with everyone.
Yes, we look forward to practice with you.
Yes,
and everyone else. Yeah.
All right. That, anything else, Renee? Oh, okay. That's it, I guess. Well, thank you for coming on. And last one. Let's see, Patricia. Was on earlier. Maybe had a comment. Patricia, do you have something else today? You're muted on your end. Maybe the hand was just left up from before. Nope, it's gone down. Okay. Well, that might, I think we covered our questions and we did it within the hour, basically. So just, you know, we're all grateful to Minja Rinpoche for this practice and for the teachings. And I just want to say on behalf, I think, of everybody who's received this practice and who's on today, just to extend our appreciation and gratitude to Antonia and Cortland. I love having the instructors come on, particularly have two, and you both have a certain kind of expertise or in a kind of depth into these teachings and this practice, but have a very different sort of perspective that's so complementary. So we want to thank you for that and give you an opportunity for any closing comments or exhortations, inspirations, moving on to for everyone listening today.
So I think I would just start with saying thank you. Thank you for coming on to this webinar and for sharing your experience and for having this opportunity to have a sense of community. And someone mentioned that thinking about all of us as we're doing the practice. I think to recognize the kind of connection and bond there is between people who have the empowerment, who receive the empowerment together and who are doing the same practice, I think that's really something that's very enriching for me. And I just look forward to us all to continue practice and to continue to learn from it and to be continuously also having an exchange. It's something extremely beautiful that we share. And I think this is so meaningful to spend one time on it. And I think knowing that others are making the same commitment is just making it easier also. It's a great support. So thank you so much for that.
Cortland?
Ditto. Yeah, just to thank you all. It's just a blessing to be able to share this with everybody. And thank you, Max, for all your help. And it's great to do a webinar with you, Antonia. So
thank you for inviting me, Cort. And thank you for all that you do. I really enjoy your translation every day.
And thank you. Somebody who wasn't able to join did ask. So, of course, this will be recorded and put on the site, as we mentioned earlier. And as Cort mentioned, we're going to do this again, and we hope to, you know, as he said, as the kind of community grows around this, we'll have more and more. And I'm really excited if we have a chance to have Minja Rinpoche join us as well at one in the future. All right, thank you
very much. You are all the Waitara pioneers. You know, someday, you know, a few years from now, we'll look back and then hopefully we'll have a big thriving community of people doing Waitara, and we'll look back on these, all the stuff we were doing and the questions we had, and everything was a mess and unclear. And it's your generosity and commitment to practice and helping to work all this out that is going to make it easier for the practitioners in the future. So thanks for your patience and willingness just to dive in as we kind of take on new practices like this. It's really wonderful.
All right, take care, everyone. See you next time.